We come from Sydney in Australia, and there was three brothers, one going to school with Kirk, that's Tim going to school with Kirk, Andrew, the middle brother, going to school with myself, and John was going to school with Andrew and I as well. Gary we found at the beach, and it was just a couple of very early bands falling to bits and ending up, you know, together. We thought, you know, Johnny was the last member to join, I guess, so we were looking for a good drummer, and it was like the kid brother, you know, the Farris's kid brother. Oh yeah, I guess we'll give him a go, and he was very good. And so we've been the same member since, and it was about 5 years ago, and we started up in the North Shore of Australia, it's the beach areas, and we played a lot of surf clubs and the big beach pubs, a lot of surfy fans, things like that. And we slowly moved around Australia through the suburbs and cities and that. And took, we got a contract and we've done four albums now. So it's been very progressive, you know, up, it's very strong, slowed up and up and up. You know?
Tim, now you're one of the three brothers. I expect it was quite a noisy household when you were kids, learning to play guitars and drums and so on. I expect the family were quite pleased to get rid of you into a group eventually, weren't they?
Yes, mum and dad were very supportive, but I still remember having to have the serious discussion with mum and dad about Johnny leaving school so that we could play more gigs, you know. And they understood, and, you know, he was only 15 at the time and had only really started school, yeah. So, but it was good that they encouraged us all the way, you know. In fact, Dad really sort of got us all started in music. And that you know, Dad actually sort of bought us all our first instruments, and when we all turned sort of the age of eight, he'd say to each one of us, you know, well, you know, what would you like to play? Like for me, he said, would you like to play the trombone or the guitar? Thank God I picked the guitar. I don't think the trombone would suit me, you know, somehow.
For Australian bands that are starting out, Michael mentioned the surf clubs, the beach clubs and the pubs. That's a staple diet for most groups in Australia today, isn't it? You learn your trade and you get your experience playing a lot of cover songs, other people's songs, learning your trade that way.
Yeah, you do actually. It's I think it's very good for Australian bands because it's not at all an easy audience to please, because there are so many bands all trying to do the same thing. And until recently, it's been that way, where you sort of had to go out and prove yourself live first for, you know, at least 6 months to a year, you know, and then, you know, if you could prove to the record company sort of thing that you'd get a bit large following, you know, and so on and so on, and they could see the progression, you know, although it's really changing rapidly now.
I was going to say that it must have changed in some ways that... Michael, perhaps you can answer this one. With the success of Little River Band, AC/DC, very very different musically, and more recently Men at Work, Ice House, Real Life, Australian Crawl, I mean, they just keep coming, they keep invading America and Britain. Has it made it easier or harder for bands like yourselves to get record deals and to get the kind of exposure that's going to put you on top and give you the success and feedback that you need?
I think initially... It has to make it easier, because the world starts focusing in on Australia. Instead of having that incredible first rung on the ladder of people actually taking you seriously, that's all sort of gone now. And I think most people think beyond kangaroos and beer and whatever from Australia, and they realise there is actually a creative art scene, and there's a music scene there, and there's a movie scene and books, etc., etc. So from that, we feel like we're on equal ground now. So from there on, I hope that Australian bands will just be considered as bands, not Australian bands, you know, international bands from now on. If that happens, I'll be really happy. I think there's a lot more bands in Australia, and a lot of them are going to have to get overseas to really make people have an even better idea of what's going on. You know? It's still only a few bands, really, that have got overseas. Yeah.
And do you gain experience from the groups that do come away from Australia and go on to, I mean, Men at Work, probably the most typical example of a success in recent years, in the last couple of years. I mean, they've been phenomenally successful in Europe, Britain, America. Now, have you learnt as groups yourselves anything from those bands as they've come home at Christmas after world tours and so on?
Yeah,
I guess so. I'm in a work of the first Australian band that made it on Australian terms. In other words, they didn't go overseas to play, say, LRB, to go and play American music better than Americans could play it.
Or Air Supply,
Olivia, etc. They're one of the first bands to even have a surprise hit in their own country, you know? And nobody knew who they were in Australia. They were doing a support with us when they had a number one. And so it's that sort of situation is really good. You hear about things, you learn the good and bad points of overseas. You get an idea of what's going on. Because mainly all these bands know each other. So that's a good start. We're not that competitive in Australia because everybody's quite original, I think.
Tim, Michael mentioned a few minutes ago that, we have just released in Britain the first album by INXS, but in point of fact you have four albums to your credit. That's a lot of recorded material. So take us backwards in time a little bit to the first album and then subsequently the ones that you released from there on.
Well, as I was saying before, we spend about a year working very, very often in the pubs and that sort of thing. I think in our first year as INXS we played to... I don't know how many people, but we played about 280 shows or something incredible, literally 5-6 nights a week. And we did that for a whole year until we actually signed a contract. And then we did our first album, which was our debut album, just entitled INXS. And that did very well and went gold, which was, you know, nice for a debut album. And then we recorded Underneath the Colours, which was really... studio album, the band kind of getting their heebie-jeebies off in the experimental sort of fashion. We did it with an old sort of Richard Clapton was a from the late 60s, I guess, singer-songwriter from Australia, which is kind of interesting because we were sort of one of the newer type bands and we wanted some of his influence. And I think he, cleverly enough, wanted some of ours and on his next album. And then we did Shabu Shabar, which is the third album, and that was the first one to be released overseas. And it was released in America and ended up being top 40. And we had a hit in America too off that album called The One Thing. And so we went over there and we spent a lot of time there last year touring America. We spent 7 months, I think, touring all over the States. And then we came home via England to record The Swing after doing the original Sim with Nile Rodgers in New York.
I was going to say, before we get to The Swing, before we make our trip back to London, because you're dashing around the world. Now, this is where Nile Rodgers, who's famous for his funk soul in Chic, and then most recently... for that excellent work he did producing David Bowie's Let's Dance album. Now, he heard you in Toronto, I believe, were on tour in Canada and fell in love with you and said, look, I'd like to produce you. You must have felt very privileged because of his background and his experience with David Bowie.
Well, especially me, because being the guitar player, you know, I really like his playing on the Bowie album, which coincidentally is mostly him. And
not Stevie Ray Vaughan, as a lot of people think.
Exactly. I mean, he only played the solo on Let's Dance. That's all he did. I mean, Kallis Alomar played quite a bit as well. But, you know, I know Niall's playing so well, you know, because I've got just about every album Chic ever made, and he's worked with Michael Jackson, and, you know, I've got to take my hat off to him as a guitar player. I think he's fantastic. So I was, when he actually walked into our dressing room, you know, and said, can I have a beer with you guys? You know, I literally sort of nearly fell off my chair, you know, I couldn't believe it. And so I was probably a little more knocked out and nervous about working with him than some of the other guys in the group. And, none of us really knew what to expect from him as a producer. But really, he surprised us all by just partying, basically. He just wanted to party, and he was very positive. We only did the song twice, and... from a production point of view, he really didn't do as much as we all would have expected him to do. Because after chatting with him in the dressing room after the show where we met him, he was telling us about another group he'd been working with, a young band from Canada, he'd had, you know, a few problems here and there with, and it took him a long time to produce our album and that, so we were thinking, oh, you know, he might be one of those producers that takes everything apart and puts it all back together bit by bit, but no, it was completely the opposite. It was virtually, the original Sin was recorded live. It was a jam.
A positive experience working with Nile Rodgers on Original Sin, Michael, but not necessarily a positive reaction in America to the song, perhaps because its lyrics seem maybe a little racist to some people.
Oh, well, they're not meant to be racist at all.
No, I know they're not meant to be, but perhaps they were construed by some people be a little critical, whatever.
No, actually, it's the opposite is the problem. It's just a sensitive issue, I guess, and it's nothing that we can... I wouldn't put it down to not being that successful because of that. But no, I think it's more of a sensitive spot that people don't want to be reminded of. You know, in South Carolina, they don't want to talk. They don't want to know about a song that deals with anything to do with that. You know, and people won't. It's down to boring things like advertising time. An advertiser won't sell advertising time to a radio station because he doesn't like the idea of the song. And really, the song was about. It's meant to be positive. It's meant to be about dreams and holding on to them, you know, and things like. Shock things like, you know, assassinations like Martin Luther, you know, and trying to break away from that. Trying to, you know, as he said, he has a dream.
Also. Yeah. It's election year at the moment too, which is causing a few things with, you know, certain people running for presidency and all that. And I just think it basically it was just a bad timing. Really, they don't want to be reminded about anything that even brings up the subject of racism, which is a shame, really, because Nile Rodgers, who produced it, is black, obviously, and it's more really the white people that. I think are objecting to it.
When we wrote it, Andrew and I are thinking of, we're just thinking of New York and the dance clubs and just really getting into the dance clubs. We used to record a lot of the KLAB and all the black radio stations, and I guess we wrote it with that in mind. And it was a dance hit, you know. So that was good. That's what we got. And last thing we thought of was it being hit in Australia, and it was. It went to number one, so I don't know what's going on.
Do I note, Michael, that you're beginning to catch a bit of an American accent yourself there?
I have many accents.
And it's American today. Who knows, tomorrow it could be Turkish.
Yeah.
Well, now, Nile Rodgers has been a high point in your career recently, but on your way back to England, to Australia via England, you stopped in and you've been using some of our fantastic recording studios on this new album, The Swing, right?
Yeah. We went into the Manor. We worked with Nick Lorne, who's a young, one of the new breed producers, I guess you could call him, and he liked the Manor for the drum room. So we did about 2 months there doing mainly rhythm tracks and some vocals and guitars and things like that. And we also used some East and West. We used a bunch, really. We used about six studios in this album. And we went back to Australia and finished it there, mainly, in a place called Rhinoceros in Paradise. And we really like the English studios. But
wait a minute. Rhinoceros is the studio and Paradise is the place, right?
Yes, that's right. <yeah. laughs> Paradise is the place. No.
On the
almost
head.
On the head, yeah. It's different places have different, you know, different countries have different idea of what a good sound is, strangely enough. I mean, to Nick, he goes into a studio in Australia, some studio, and he goes, no, that's nothing like what I want. You know, he just won't touch it. And to the Australian producers, it's perfect, you know. So I guess it's, yeah, different strokes, but I think it worked out well. It's a nice mix. Nick's a very unusual producer, you know. He's a very new techniques, you know. He doesn't really touch reverb and things like that, you know.
So you finished up the recording, mixing and producing of that album, The Swing, in Australia, and then back on the road. I know you've done some European dates and finished up with one date only in Britain. A country I'm sure you wanted to play more dates in, surely.
Yes, that's very true. But we thought, well, the longer we leave it till we come back and play here, the more exciting it'll be when we do. And now that we've had a taste, we all sort of can't wait to come back. So we look like coming back in September to England to play. But we had to do a lot in Europe, basically, because the Original Sin has been very popular in a lot of countries there. We had number one in France with it, and it's top 10 in places like Belgium, Portugal, Italy, all that sort of thing. And there's still, I mean, Europe is such a vast sort of expanse of countries, you know, it takes a long time to get to all of them as well. So we spend a lot of time touring France and Germany, and we did some shows in Belgium, and we sort of, this show we've just done in England now is the last show we'll do on this part of the European tour until next September.
Now, I was one of the audience at the show in London at the Astoria last week, and I must say I was in the minority. Most of the people in the audience seem to be Australians and coming in there to cheer and support you. Mm. Has that been the case on the tour? Have you had a lot of fellow Australians that have come out and supported you?
Not at all in Europe. We've had in a couple of places in France, you know, you sort of, well, you got the language thing there, you see. So as soon as you hear some rowdy English voice coming from the audience, you know, you sort of think immediately, especially when they call out old songs from albums that were never even released over here, you sort of think, oh, there's an Australian out there, you know. But we don't really like that too much. I mean, we're, you know, it's very nice to be supported by them, and we really appreciate it. But we want to prove ourselves on our own grounds, on our own terms, in new countries. Which is a big reason why we'll be coming back here and doing a lot more shows in September.
Tim mentioned, you know, fellow Australians that know the songs, the lyrics of In Excess. Now, I was reading your biography, and you're quoted, Michael, as saying that that you're a band from a generation who've lived with the effects of future shock from infancy, which sounds very heavy, especially in the big cities. You see so many people who have hit 16 and gone into automation. Now, what do you mean by that? Is that something that you seriously consider and seriously think about, that kids today are living a totally different lifestyle to their parents?
Yeah, I think so. Not totally different, but I know, I mean, I can see it, and I've heard it being said. I've heard it being said by older people, where they cannot relate to our social patterns now are utterly different than what they once were. I mean, it's a fact, really. Family life, for one thing, is an utterly different concept, you know. And what I'm trying to say is, we will be a generation, by the time, instead of being sort of 50 and going, gosh, the world has changed, it happens so much faster. It's happened to me now. I'm 24, and I'm trying to catch up with computers, you know? And if I can't get that to go by the time I have children, I'll be gone, you know? it's just, I guess it is, it really is quantum leaps now. It's not every 100 years that we go through major changes. It's like every 10, 15, you know?
We was level, we don't always level, but we kind of criticize our own groups that leave Britain and go off to America and get success there. Typical example would be someone like Psychedelic Furs or Flock of Seagulls, who have been far more successful in the last 2 years in America than they ever were in Britain. Are you given the same level of criticism when you leave Australia? Because that's all you can do. There are very few countries in the media area. I mean, there's New Zealand and the Pacific countries that you can go to. But to get a real response to your music, you've got to travel a long way. So is the same criticism leveled at Australian bands when they go to America and come to Europe?
It has been a lot to a lot of Australian bands, especially in the past. I think it's changing a lot now. But, for instance, unfortunately for a lot of bands, I nearly mentioned a name, which I won't, you know, they've come home after having enormous success overseas, and you know, it's a real shame, you know, can't sell a ticket, you know, and whereas, and we didn't really know how to avoid that, but we just followed our instincts when we went overseas last year, and we kept on talking to people back home and releasing new videos and new singles and
coming, sort of breaking the tours up by coming home for a month or so, and then going back, and then coming, you know, and that seemed to keep things fairly in touch, because while we were overseas, in fact, early this year, touring Europe for the first time, the swing was released and went into the charts nationally at number one, so it obviously wasn't hurting us any, and we're very grateful for that. But then again, our success in Australia has been much, as Michael said earlier, sort of a progression, you know, a much steadier certain leaps, but it's taken like 4 years to get where we did. So I think a lot of our fans are very much loyal ones. And also we never forget where we're from. You know, we'll never pack up our bags and go live, I don't think, yeah, in LA or something like that. We'll always remember that we're Australian, and that's where we're from.
Are you sure?
Yeah, it's a new age for Australian music, and it's a new way to approach the rest of the world. We've always considered that we can be an Australian band and do overseas tours and come back, and that somebody's got to be able to do that one day instead of going to live overseas. You know, nothing wrong with that, but we've grown up. The Australian music has grown up now. You don't have to go and stay at somebody's place the rest of your life. You know,
but equally, as you've grown up with a very successful and well-organized music scene now, especially anyone that's say 15 now is growing up with a tradition that's been going on successfully in Australia for the last 10 years. It's well established, in other words. But even so, I'm sure you must admit that coming to Britain with the traditions of the Rolling Stones, mm-hmm, and the Beatles, and musicians that you can bump into on a street, must be a hell of an experience for you.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it is everywhere, you know. Same with going to New York and so with that. I think England is a place you direct, bands have always directed their focus at, and Australia as far as a serious music scene, you know, where the real stuff has come from. At the same time, most of this band was brought up very much on American Philadelphia, you know, New York, Motown scene, you know, as well. So there's those two poles that sort of attract us.
Tim, your one-date show in London gave us a little taste of INXS and their music. You've got a lot of material in your repertoire. I know when you played the other night, you could have probably played for hours, going back four albums. So we will hope to see INXS back in Britain, in the next 6 months, do you think?
Hopefully back in September. That's what we're working on at the moment. We'll finish up our American tour towards early September. Then we come back, hopefully, for some more shows in England. We want to play, you know, up some of the outside of London areas as well, and we have to do a certain show in Germany that we're looking forward to, and then we do our second tour of Japan after we leave here, which is another place that is very much happening for the band. We actually really have a fond place in our hearts for Japan, because it's in the Pacific and it's close, and it's only 8 hours from plane, by a plane, you know, whereas it takes us 30 hours to get from Australia to here.
Hit singles are predominantly what make a band or break them in this country. If you don't have a hit, if you have a hit and then you don't follow it up with another one, unfortunately someone else takes your place. Are you that kind of band where you have to keep getting those? I know it pays the bills and you get deals from record companies, so you need some sort of success, but does it worry you a lot?
Yeah, depends where we are. You know, we play by ear. In England, I think we're probably going to be, who knows, but at the moment we're working as an album band, you know, and we're just going to take our time here, you know.
You'll conquer the country one way or the other, right?
Maybe.
if I can add to that, we've never actually really sat down and tried to write a hit record, you know. It's never... We're a bit selfish as far as writing when it comes to things like that. We'd rather write a whole mess of stuff and just see what comes out of it, you know. Fortunately, it's always worked for us in other parts of the world, and I have no doubt it won't do the same here.